tonight on Arena. Movie reviews including Frankenstein and Springsteen, The Life of Amelia Earhart on stage, and we'll look at Harlan Coben's TV series Lazarus. @51551 as always, if you'd like to text the programme tonight, you can email arena@rte.ie, and we're on Instagram @RTE_arena. Now, Thursday night is movie night on Arena. First up, Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, in which the bear plays the boss. Jeremy Allen White is Bruce Springsteen in crisis during the recording of the Nebraska album in 1982. Next, in a week of high-profile art thefts, Josh O'Connor stages a less successful gallery heist in Kelly Reichardt's The Mastermind. Film number three is The Spin, an Irish indie road movie in which two Tyrone men drive from Omagh to Cork in a desperate attempt to save their record shop from the clutches of a greedy landlord. And finally, 110 years after the first big screen adaptation, Guillermo del Toro gives us his reanimation of Mary Shelley's monster. Oscar Isaac is Victor Frankenstein and Jacob Elordi is the creature. Dee Malumbi and John McGuire have been to the movies for us. John, we're going to start with Springsteen. Where are we in his story at the beginning of the film?
Well, I didn't know what to expect from a Bruce Springsteen biography. This is Scott Cooper's moody and introspective retelling, like you say, Rick, of the recording of the Nebraska album in the early 1980s. And it totally caught me by surprise. In many ways, this is a film that follows the familiar formula for a rock biography. There's lots of swinging guitars, puddles of sweat, flannel shirts, acres of denim. But Cooper and Jeremy Allen White, who, with the aid of a pair of brown contact lenses covering the baby blues, gives a very good Bruce Springsteen, they're chasing something that's actually trickier to capture. It's a poetic expression of the kind. How do you go from being a blue-collar guy from around the way into becoming a rock god? And it's not the sweeping, bombastic career retrospective that I was thinking it would be. It's a rather tightly focused and slightly maudlin expression of what the kids today might call imposter syndrome. It's about a guy who's not sure he's good enough to become Bruce Springsteen because he's on the precipice between maintaining his authenticity as a musician, the demands of the music industry, people telling him he's brilliant, and a broken and damaged childhood at the hands of his father, Duke. Dutch, who is superbly played by Stephen Graham. So he goes to his manager, who's played by Jeremy Strong, is a very kind and affectionate man who is deeply fond of Bruce. And he arranges for him to go to a rented house in the middle of nowhere in beside a lake in New Jersey, where he sits with a guitar and a four-track, brand new four-track recording desk, and puts together a suite of songs inspired by the stuff around him, the things that he's going through, the movie Badlands, Terrence Malick's Badlands, and a book of short stories by Flannery O'Connor. And that's the movie. There's a few bits of stage work. We see him on stage now and again, and we see a lot of studio things, a lot of time in the studio. We see a demo of Born in the USA, but the rest of it is the songs from the Nebraska album, which are quiet and quite dark, and Bruce trying to come to terms with the fact that he's becoming Bruce Springsteen.
It's an interesting one, Dee, in that because it's a single album that you're going through here, I mean, how deep do we go into the process of the making of the album? What sort of detail do we get? And I suppose, how interesting is it if possibly you're not that interested in individual Bruce Springsteen albums?
Yeah, I would say it's quite in depth and quite interesting, actually, because I think that at this stage, when you think of the likes of, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody, Rocket Man, however, a number of musical biopics, I think there's become this association with them being very kind of Oscar vying and Oscar grabbing. And you've got, the lead actors who are playing these, you know, iconic singers kind of having these like big emotional moments and stuff like that. So I really appreciated that we got into the kind of more technical aspect of what it takes to actually make music and make albums and make art, which you don't normally get in this kind of genre. So I really found that very fascinating. So in the film, we follow Bruce as he's like, recording the songs from Nebraska. He goes through such immaculate details in terms terms of like getting this very specific microphone, this very specific mixer to create the sound he wants. He later runs an echo through every number, even though he is advised that, you know, this could really affect, this could really mess up the songs. But he's like, no, this is what I want. I know my vision for this. It ends up kind of slowing down the records and producing some really, really interesting sounds. And it's really quite beguiling and different to the average musical biopic narrative in that way, like I say. And I mean, Bruce kind of talks about wanting to create the feel that he's the only one in this room, kind of emphasizing the intimate personal nature of the album. And there are some really interesting cutaway scenes. You know, John would have mentioned there Jeremy Strong's performance as John Lando. We sometimes cut away to John Lando kind of speaking with his wife about what Bruce is doing with this album in terms of like exploring something deeper and darker and more interior than we've ever seen before. And those moments give us some really interesting little insights into the man that Bruce Springsteen is. So it's really quite different in terms of this genre and really, really fascinating.
Okay, let's have a listen to something from it. This is Jeremy Allen White as Bruce and Paul Walter Hauser as the sound engineer Mike Batlin, and they're doing one of those recordings, and then they come to what turns out to be quite an important decision.
You want to know why I did what I did? Sir, I guess it's just a meanness in this world. I think we got that.
Oh, yeah, we got that one. So this song got a name?
I was gonna call it Starkweather, but now I'm thinking Nebraska.
Still would have been a decent album title.
Mm-hmm.
John, what about Jeremy Allen White here? People probably know him from The Bear, from playing Carmy in The Bear. This is a big, major full-screen role for him.
Well,
does he live up to it?
I think very early on you forget the fact that it's Jeremy Allen White and you totally buy him as Bruce Springsteen, and that's to the film's enormous credit. He's really good at the quiet stuff. And then when things get a bit louder, he's really good on stage. They go to a place called the Stone Pony, which as far as I know, I'm not a Bruce aficionado, but as far as I know, is a real bar where Bruce would have played in the early part of his career. And he takes the stage and they do cover versions with a kind of a local band. He's really good on stage. He's really good on stage, on screen, if you know what I mean. He's a charismatic actor. And this is a very much a downplayed performance. It's very introspective. It's a quiet Bruce. But I think the relationship that he forms with Faye, who's played by Odessa Young, who's a local waitress and a single mother, and they form a relationship about halfway through the movie. And she's a composite of the kind of girlfriends that Bruce Springsteen would have had at the time in and around New Jersey. She's an ordinary person. He's an ordinary person. And they have an ordinary love affair. And I think the two of them together is really lovely. It's very tender and touching, but there's a rawness to it that is then reflected in the kind of what we've just heard, that kind of raw, rootsy music that he was producing as well. And it's all very nicely combined.
Yeah, I know that you felt that there might have been a missed opportunity in terms of the exploration of his mental health in the film. You felt it might be a little bit rushed?
Yeah, I suppose it was kind of, in a way, the whole idea of Bruce Springsteen as a man who's like battling his inner demons. It is kind of interwoven throughout, you know, the film. John alluded to earlier about, you know, how this is a man who is really struggling with imposter syndrome. He's very resistant to fame. There are kind of early hints, like, for example, he doesn't like reflecting on his past. He meets an old school friend and is very, very reticent to talk about that period in his life at all. So I suppose there are kind of, you know, moments where we think that maybe there's something else going on there in terms of battling his inner demons. But I did think that there's kind of a, without kind of giving too much away, there's a breakdown that comes like quite late on in the film, and I just felt like it maybe could have been interwoven a bit more strongly into the film. But at that, I thought that, you know, in fairness to Scott Cooper, who's such a fantastic director, like his past credits would include the likes of Crazy Heart, Black Mass, Hostiles, Out of the Furnace. He's always been impressive to me as a director. I think he really manages to kind of balance, you know, those more technical aspects that I mentioned earlier, the big kind of louder performances, like, you know, the rendition of Born in the USA is one of the best scenes in the movie, but the smaller performances as well, and the romantic storyline, which sometimes, you know, in these kind of movies is kind of like it isn't really properly integrated, but it worked quite well here. He balances all those elements so well that I can be a little forgiving of that, I feel.
Okay, let's go for stars on this. Dee?
I'd give it 4 stars. I thought that it was a really, really enjoyable film. I think people need to check it out. And yeah, that Born in the USA scene, it really gave me chills, I have to say.
Okay, John?
Oh, 4 for me as well. I mean, if a fraction of the people that queue up to see Bruce Springsteen in Croke Park every time he comes to town, if a fraction of those people go see this film, it'll be a massive hit. So it deserves it. It's a good movie.
Okay, next up to Kelly Reichardt's The Mastermind. Internet boyfriend Josh O'Connor plays Jamie Mooney, who has big plans but no actual job or means to convince his wife and parents that he's a capable person. D, when we meet Josh O'Connor's JB Mooney, we meet him at a very unusual point for a heist movie. Where is he in his life and what's going on with him?
Yeah, so Josh O'Connor plays this character called James Blaine Mooney, who's basically a failed architect. He's a family man. He's married. He has these 2 young sons. And he basically decides to concoct this plan to steal 4 paintings from his local art gallery in broad daylight. And then he's later kind of forced on the run. So when we meet James Blaine, I suppose he's quite an emasculated character in terms of he and his family are currently living with his parents, who are played by Bill Camp and Hope Davis. And the grandparents very much rule the roost. We see them kind of sitting at the respective ends of the, you know, dinner table, and they kind of dominate the conversation while the rest of the family are like quite quiet and everything. James is the one who's unemployed. His wife is the breadwinner. You know, at one point he calls his wife asking if, you know, she can mind the kids. And she's like, I'm at work, can't you? So I suppose there's a bit of like,
that's when he's just about to do the heist.
Yes. So that's a bit of like role reversal going on. We see him like being forced to borrow money from his mother. Both his parents and his wife make these kind of subtle remarks to undermine him. But I have to say, in fairness to Kelly Reichardt's direction, all of these elements of the story are very quite understated and underplayed. And it's only kind of gradually that you figure out exactly why James is motivated to go on the hype, because basically his life is just kind of ordinary, kind of dull, lacking excitement, lacking vitality, and he just kind of wants to do something, I think, is kind of a big motivating factor for him.
John, this isn't Ocean's 11. This is far from it. It is earthy. It is lo-fi.
It's still very much observational. I mean, this is a pretty good, he does pull off, I know the title is ironic and he's far from a mastermind, JB, but he does pull off the heist, and Kelly Reichardt gives us pretty much a blow by blow as to how it would have happened. His problem, I suppose, is that he's not a criminal. He's just somebody who's kind of looking for thrills, and he trusts the wrong people. He has no faith in himself, so he believes in everybody else, and the people that he has as his accomplices let him down, and that is to his undoing. But it goes from that kind of jazzy amateur sort of crime comedy. There's elements of humor to it. And it turns then into this really affecting and stirring character-driven morality play. And it's set against the backdrop we hear constantly on the TV news. We see Walter Cronkite, the famous American newsreader. It's all about Vietnam. Everything around them is about Vietnam. Why isn't JB in Vietnam? He's certainly, you know, old enough to be there. So it's not, he's not just shirking his family responsibilities or his responsibilities as a father or his responsibilities as a law-abiding citizen, but it's the entire milieu that Reichardt creates of pressure. He's under enormous pressure from everywhere, and this seems to be this game of thrills that he puts together to steal these not terribly valuable, not terribly important paintings from this small little rural art museum seems to be the only way that he can let the steam out, you know, and relieve some of the pressure that he's under.
This is a moment from the film. This is Bill Camp as JB's father and Hope Davis as his mother. And Alana Haim is in this as well, who is Terry, JB's wife. And they're all sitting around the dinner table discussing the recent heist with JB sitting at the dinner table as well.
It seems inconceivable to me that these abstract paintings would be worth the trouble. I'm not entirely convinced they thought this through.
James and I were just there. Tommy, elbows off the table. What a horrible thing for those young girls.
Are you kidding? It's probably the most exciting thing that's ever happened to them. They'll be talking about it for the rest of their lives.
Of course. There are dark markets. I suppose one could buy any kind of commodity there. A beautiful painting, perhaps. That, I am afraid, is outside my realm of expertise.
Dee, we had Kelly Reichardt and Josh O'Connor on the programme earlier in the week, and Kelly spoke specifically about not wanting the audience to be able to predict the beats of this film, and especially in a heist film, which can be quite formulaic depending on how you lay it out. Does she succeed with that, do you think?
I think so, because there's quite a mix of like comedy and drama in this film, and yet it's never quite what you expect. And watching this film, I was really, one thing that really came to mind is when it comes to a heist movie, I hope that the film doesn't suffer as a result of this, but I kind of felt like it was more of a critic's heist movie than necessarily an audience heist movie, because when it comes to that genre, I suppose typically you'd have these expectations of it, like, you know, being exciting and there being like a last minute turnaround and this kind of stuff.
Whereas getting the gang together, all of that,
exactly. But this film like doesn't really follow that structure at all. When the robbery takes place, which I found like to be a really well-directed scene, because it's just so unexpected. Like, things do not go as smoothly as you would hope that for them to be. And while it's not slapstick funny, there's kind of subtle humor, there's subtle clumsiness to the events. And another scene that really stood out for me was when JB is hiding the paintings that are now stolen in a pigsty. And the scene is quite long, quite drawn out, but it's so, so funny because he just strikes you as so inept, and you're kind of crying at the guy because he's such a like tragic comic character.
I know, he might be an idiot, yeah, but he's not stupid. And his father, who's played by Bill Camp, is a judge, and once he's the police obviously come knocking, he can rely on his privilege to grease the snare that's circling his neck. Mm-hmm. And he knows he's going to be able to at least slip out of it without any kind of repercussion, just by dropping a name. So there is that sense throughout that this guy can coast through life. He might have set his own level, and he might not be able to achieve anything, but nothing at the same time is going to get in his way until something does get in his way. We're not going to spoil that, but that's where I found the true surprise was how Reichardt ends the film, the last three or four scenes, that whole sequence of what happens to him and how those two worlds collide. I found really, really interesting. Yeah.
Josh O'Connor as an actor is somebody who's hugely on the rise at the moment. He's in the next Knives Out film, The History of Sound, Rebuilding. They're also coming as well. He's also filming the lead in the new Joel Coen film as well. Is he somebody that you like to see on screen? Is he a presence you're happy with?
I think he's very good. I mean, watching this film, I did kind of feel like, could I see another actor play this character? Possibly. For me, when it comes to the top performances of Josh O'Connor, The Crown will always stick out for me, and also Emma, because I just think he brings some brilliant comedy. So I do think that we've probably seen him better. But at that, you know, it's kind of up to him to carry the movie. Like, we see the likes of, you know, Alana Haim, Bill Camp, later in the film, John McGarrow and Gabby Hoffman pop up. But all of them always like have quite short scenes. So it really is down to Josh O'Connor to carry the movie. And he does so very ably, in fairness. I just think that it's maybe not his top career performance necessarily.
Stars from you?
I would give this 3.5 stars. I think there's depth here if you go digging, but if you'll pardon the pun, maybe not quite a lot of impression because of the artsy thing.
I'm not sure we will pardon the pun.
No, I'm not going to pardon that pun. No, that's terrible pun.
John?
I like this film enormously. I like the tone of it, that melancholy. I like Reichardt's unhurried pace. I like the muted, grainy visual aspect of it. It felt to me like a lost film from the 1970s, rather than she creates that world extremely well. And I think there's her eye for careful detail and O'Connor's abilities as a character actor make it gripping. It's really, really interesting work. Yeah. So 4 stars for me.
Okay. Our third film this week, The Spin. Brenneck O'Connor and Owen Colgan are Dermot and Elvis friends who own a record shop in Omagh. They're behind with the rent, and then Dermot spots an ad that could turn things around for them. John, tell us a little bit more about this, about the premise. What does this remind you of?
Yeah, I think you've wrapped it up there, Rick.
Okay,
that's pretty much
John,
what happens. This is a goofy, Irish, low-budget, Irish, independent, goofy, buddy road movie. But like you say, a pair of music-obsessed record shop owners who hit the road with the prospect of a big payday. Dermot is played by Brenneck O'Connor. Elvis is played by Owen Colgan. They sell vinyl to the people of Tyrone in Omagh. At least that's the plan. They don't sell a lot of records. They're under pressure from rent from their sadistically mean landlady, who's played by Tara Lynn O'Neill. He sees the ad. A character played by Barry Devlin from The Horselips is selling a bunch of Robert Johnson, the old blues man, records for £30, €30, whatever it is. And they think they could sell those records for many tens of thousands of euros. So they get into the car, an old car, and go down to Cork with the prospect of a score, and adventures await. But just like Robert Johnson is supposed to have done at the crossroads on that fateful night, are they selling their soul for riches? That's the question that occurs to them as they're about halfway down the road. There's elements of High Fidelity here. There's also elements of Paddy Branagh's I Went Down, the ultimate Irish road movie. Mm-hmm. It's all very broad, all very slapdash, but likeable enough at times all the same. The scripted material, I felt a bit flat and a bit obvious, but there's plenty of improvised, or what they feel like improvised asides, daft little riffs, little dialogue notes that are a lot more engaging. Elvis wears a T-shirt of Blind Joe Death, which is the first John Fahey album from 1957, so immediately he's okay by me. Dermot is a singer-songwriter who's kind of an ideologue for music. His total commitment to music as a way of life, and vinyl as the beating heart of that. So he's good as well. And there's something very innocent about this film, Rick. Something sweet-hearted with themes of friendship and kindness to others. So that gets an extra star as well. You know, it's hard to be mean about it, but there's just not an awful lot there.
Hey, Dee, what did you make of the main performances in it?
Yeah, I think that John kind of summarised it there in terms of it's hard to be mean about it because it is so like good natured and it's so sweet and feel good and everything. I thought that O'Connor and Colgan were very good. They bounce off each other very well. Tara Lynn O'Neill, you know, like we said, you'd recognise as the ultimate Derry Girls mammy. She's a kind of silly but entertaining enough villain here. You've got a bunch of cameos in here. Barry Devlin, Love Island's Maura Higgins, and Pussycat Doll Kimberly Wyatt also shows up. It is quite low budget in terms of its location shooting and even the general acting standards. I can see how it would play well at festivals and how it would win the likes of kind of audience awards, but because it is like quite feel good and quite sweet. There are little kind of moments in it. For example, there's a conversation between the two leads in which Elvis kind of talks about being abandoned by his father, how he fears he's going to end up like him because now he's a kind of single father to his daughter. You know, he's going through a divorce. There's a funny scene where it sounds like the start of a joke, like what do you get when you put a taxidermist, a nun and an American sexy girl hitchhiker into a car together? So it has, look, it has its moments, but yeah, there's not a huge amount to it. But like it's nice, and they're doing their best. I don't know if that sounds very patronizing.
Not sure, Rebecca. I'm going to get stars from you anyway on this.
I'll give it 3 stars.
Okay, John.
Yeah, 3 stars for me too. The Blind Joe Death t-shirt gets the extra star. But yeah, 3 stars for me. Michael Head is the guy who directed it. And you'd certainly watch another film from him. Absolutely.
Okay, finally we're going to talk about Frankenstein. You only got to see this one today, so you've had to turn your thoughts around very fast. Directed by Guillermo del Toro, stars Oscar Isaac, Jacob Elordi and Mia Goth. It's never easy to approach Frankenstein again on screen. Let's start with this. It is Oscar Isaac as Frankenstein appalling his peers at the beginning of the film by displaying a partial and reanimated cadaver. It's a head, shoulders and an arm that can catch a ball when he throws it.
This is a hearing, Doctor, not a carnival act.
You're not helping your cause, Victor. This galvanic trickery will simply not do.
Trickery. Trickery. Are you sure?
That is not trickery. That is a decision. Motor coordination between the eye of one dead man and the arm of another, infused with a new will and the rudiments of understanding.
Understanding in a brain that already died?
Release now. Please. Please always help.
Okay, Dee, chances are everybody is familiar with the story. Where are we with this version, though?
So you've got Oscar Isaac playing the brilliant but egotistical eponymous scientist Victor Frankenstein, while Jacob Elordi, known for his roles in Priscilla, Saltburn, and Netflix's The Kissing Booth trilogy. I can't believe I just admitted I watched that. But he plays the creature. So we know the story of Frankenstein. Well, obviously, there's this mad scientist. He goes about, getting all of these, different body parts. And I have to say, it's quite graphic in this particular iteration of the movie. Putting all these body parts together and creating a life, except that what works out happening is that Frankenstein doesn't really know what it means to take care of another life. I studied Frankenstein in college and I remember us doing all these feminist readings about how he's a man, he's not a mother, so he doesn't have these maternal instincts that a woman would have if she had created Frankenstein. But anyway, so there are all those elements to it, and it's quite loyal, I would say, to the Mary Shelley book, in that you've even got like the framing device, in that this story is told through Victor Frankenstein. Basically, he's found, in the middle of the ice by this sea captain who basically takes him in, and then he relays his story.
John, I wonder why actors want to take on the creature. But I mean, it can be quite an unforgiving role. People do, though, like De Niro, Rory Kinnear has done it on TV. Christian Bale's going to be doing it next year in Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Bride. What sort of fist does Jacob Elordi make of this?
I think he's very good, actually. It's perverse almost to get an actor as good looking as Jacob Elordi and as physically imposing, and then to slather him in makeup and prosthetics and just not give him any dialogue or very little dialogue. But as a physical performance, he's really impressive. It's a tough part to play, and he's later in the story when he starts to take on more human characteristics. He softens a little bit, but I like him early on when he's fresh, newborn and raging. And he's very good at that in the early sections of it. But
they're almost two performances in the same film, aren't they? Because at the beginning, in the first half, the story is told from Victor's point of view. Yeah. And that's where he can't really speak at all. In the second half, then it comes from the creature's point of view.
And he's a lot more articulate. Yeah. And I suppose Victor is playing God, and he has really no understanding of what it is that he's created. And it's up to us to understand what the monster has become, what the creature is. Elordi is good. Isaac is okay. He's a little over the top. The whole film is a little over the top. I'm very wary, Rick, of a passion project. Del Toro's desire to make this film, he first expressed it around the time of Kronos in 1992. He said his next project was going to be an adaptation of Frankenstein. And, he's had 30 years to think about this. And fair play to him. His vision of the story is lavish, absolutely, beyond expectations, full of macabre monsters and horrors and gore. It's well acted. It's beautifully scored. But at 2.5 hours, it's a bit of a slog. And it's filled with that kind of self-indulgence and slight self-importance of a project that has been brewing away in the back of Del Toro's mind for 30 years. And you feel that in that epic scale and scope of the production. And it is beautifully presented. I mean, Del Toro is probably the most impressive visual filmmaker going at the moment. But he has issues with pacing, and there is parts of this film that feel sluggish at Ben. That's being kind. Sluggish is kind.
You just reminded me that I should go back and watch Kronos.
Or any of the early films that he made, which were pacier and quicker, and he had nothing to fall back on, and there was a sense that he was actually going for it. Whereas this, there is the sense that he is going for it with the protection of a massive budget and the streaming agreement with Netflix.
Okay,
and there's little at risk.
Time has run out on us, and we're going to have to get stars from you and wrap up. So, Dee?
I preferred this a lot more to John. I have to start with that. This is my kind of movie. I thought the costumes, the sets were absolutely gorgeous. Oscar Isaac is very good in it, but Jacob Elordi, I mean, he just steals every scene. And I really did find it quite moving, even if it was a bit on the nose, even if it was very long. I didn't find it dull for a second. I thought it was majestic to behold. And Del Toro he really, really moved me at times with this movie. So I'll give it 3.5 stars. And I do think it is worth, by the way, seeing on the big screen, because it is a gorgeous film.
Mm. John?
It's a bit, perhaps appropriately, Rick, it felt a bit stitched together for me. It's partly Mary Shelley, partly fairy tale fantasy, like we've seen from Del Toro before, partly gothic romance. Mia Goth, who plays the wife and the love interest and the mother here, is really good. Partly a body horror, it's very graphic, and it's packed with homage to classics of horror cinema. So it's a bit of a monster itself, but it never, for me, justified what is an exhausting running time. It felt every minute of the 2.5 hours to me. So just 3 stars.
Okay. Dee Mullumby, John McGuire, thank you for joining me. Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere goes on general release this weekend, as does Frankenstein, and The Mastermind and The Spin will be in selected cinemas from tomorrow. And you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Even now, Howland Island is a small remote spot in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's a coral atoll that's home only to seabirds. It was one of the refueling stops for Amelia Earhart and her Irish navigator Fred Noonan in 1937 during her attempt to become the first woman to fly around the world solo. And it's where they vanished, never to be found. Blue Raincoat Theatre Company in Sligo are telling her story in Suzanne Collery's new play, Amelia. Niall Henry directs a cast of 2, actor Sandra O'Malley and aerial artist Aisling Ní Chéile. And I'm delighted that Suzanne Collery and Sandra O'Malley join us now from our Sligo studio. You're both very welcome to Arena. Sandra, I'm going to start with you. Blue Raincoat kind of has form in this when it comes to extraordinary adventurers and heroic, ill-fated expeditions with shows like Shackleton. How long have you been thinking, though, about Amelia Earhart?
Hi, Rick. First of all, thanks for having us on your show. So regarding Amelia, I think I started thinking about her about 5 years ago. I was kind of researching various sort of iconic or historical women figures, and Amelia kind of stayed with me. So yes, probably 5 years the idea was given birth to.
Suzanne, the play starts in 1937. Amelia crash landed on that final flight. Yeah. Why did she attempt such a dangerous journey at the time to fly around the world solo? It's the sort of story that people are vaguely aware of, but maybe not necessarily the detail.
Well, I think, you know, she had, as she said herself, she had flown the Atlantic and the Pacific. There was only the world left. In her heart, she was an adventurer and an explorer, and it had never been tried before, the equatorial flight around the world. She wanted to see if she could do it. That was the spirit of the woman, I think.
Some of those achievements that she broke in her lifetime, it's a huge list. There's 14 huge notable flights, the first woman to fly across the Atlantic. Mm. So many of those. Sandra, maybe tell us a little bit about those that you came across when you were thinking about her.
Yeah, so almost too many to remember, but, you know, we've got her, the first woman to fly across the Atlantic, first of all, as a passenger. She did Darby's speed records, women's world speed record, added on to that, first solo flight across for the Atlantic by a woman, first non-stop transcontinental flight by a woman, repeated other transcontinental flights as well and broke her own records, first solo flight from Hawaii to California, first solo flight from Los Angeles to Mexico City, first person to fly nonstop from Mexico to Newark, first attempt around the world, first person to fly from the Red Sea to Karachi, and then obviously making that huge attempt for the round the world where, you know, obviously she... She didn't make it past that area in the in the Pacific.
I think you've remembered most of them. That's longer than the list I have in front of me. Suzanne, it's an unusual play, Suzanne, in that you have an actor and an aerialist involved. Tell me why.
that's a good question. I think, you know, in early drafts, when we were talking about it, myself and Sandra, we were so very, very conscious of the metaphor of flight. And it was almost extra-lingual. We couldn't quite capture it in words. And so along the way, somehow organically, the decision began to form that we would do this with an aerialist. And my goodness, is it working? Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, so Rick, we've got Jocelyn Clark, who's our dramaturg, on board, and I've got to give Jocelyn and Niall Henry both agreeing that that, you know, that that would be a very good idea in terms of her doing the flying essentially on stage, because I'm not an aerialist artist. I, you know, keep me on my feet as an actor for the moment. So, you know, that's really been, you know, a huge part of the devising for us, because essentially it is a duet between Aisling and I, you know.
It is. What's that like as an actor to play? Because I'm presuming it's the sort of situation you haven't found yourself in before.
No. And so far, so good. You know, she's amazing at what she does. She's got a counterweighter, got to give Jonah serious amount of credit as well. In terms of, you know, the various things that she can do and levels of her going up into the air and down and off different hoops and different silks and what have you. It's working out extremely well, and we're still, you know, working it as we go, finding more detail in terms of my speaking the text, or, you know, how I can sort of accommodate with allowing the audience to look, you know, at the aerialist and how she is representing, you know, the story that we're telling.
I mentioned Freddie Noonan earlier on. Yeah. I mean, there's two Irish links regarding her. The solo flight across the Atlantic ended with her landing in Derry, and then Freddie Noonan, the navigator. Yes. Suzanne, that must have been a crucial relationship for her, that one with Freddie Noonan.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they were a very good team. They worked very well by all accounts together, and research shows that, and even herself, she talks a lot about Freddie. They understood the risk. They were in it together. And they understood the dangers involved. So I think it's just such an integral relationship, that relationship towards the end of her life. Of course, she didn't know that, and nor did he. But they were like-minded. They were of one mind. They were going to do it, and they were confident that they were going to do it.
I'm interested. You presumably read up an enormous amount on Amelia Earhart as part of the process here. I know you've read some of her own books, because she was an author as well as an aviator.
Yes.
What were they like?
They were factual. She was a very practical woman, So she was, you know, she explained her ship. She talked about the cockpit. She explained in great detail aviation, ideas in aviation, the aviation industry she was passionate about. She was also very poetic, and she spoke about what it is to be alone and aloft, alone, vagabonding in the sky, she says herself, Sandra, and clouds, the sun, the beauty. You know, I mean, at that time, I mean, it's so incongruous to us now, but at that time she was more likely to see a ship than she was to see a plane. You know, there were no planes. It was her. It was her in the sky. And she's very poetic about that. And I think she really, really loved that. That was, you know, the impetus to get into the air defined her life, I would say. And so that really comes across in the book as well. And she was quite didactic in lots of ways. And she taught through her books. And she also spoke about women's causes. She was very passionate about women at that time in the 1920s and 30s, where they were very much still within a domestic sphere and that they weren't supposed to quit. And she was also in the aviation industry, which was, you know, very male dominated. So she was very passionate about her causes and women's right to equality.
Sandra, I'm interested as to how you approach playing somebody who actually lived as opposed to a fictional character. What's the difference for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was chatting briefly to your researcher today, and I was kind of saying, you know, Winnie and Happy Days for me, I was allowed to have my own version of Winnie because, you know, Winnie is like an imagined woman. Same with Mother Courage. With playing somebody real, like Amelia Earhart, to be honest, I'm an actor playing Amelia. So Amelia will be my version. I'm not trying to convince the world that I am Amelia. It's great, you know, if it works and the audience accept and understand my version, if you like, of Amelia. But I couldn't really attempt to play a real woman like that because, you know, she's a theatrical device for me. That's not to kind of, you know, take any heart or any passion out of it at all. It's more, you know, what we can do using the idea of Amelia and the play that Suzanne has written, which is done in sort of different time frames, you know, how we can bring all these devices together to sort of produce something quite theatrical. So the idea of Amelia, like, I carry with me almost like a tool, you know, and it's where, you know, myself and the aerialist and the director, the writer, the dramaturg, sound, light, designer, take it from there and give her and give it its own life.
Well, for now,
that makes sense.
If it does, for now, all I can do is wish you best of luck with the rest of the rehearsals as they go on. Suzanne Collery and Sandra O'Malley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
Amelia is at the Factory Performance Space in Sligo from the 3rd to the 15th of November, and you'll find more ticket details at blueraincoat.com. Now, earlier this week on Arena, I spoke with impossibly prolific author Harlan Coben about his new TV thriller Lazarus. It's out now on Prime Video, as well as one of the drama's lead actors, Bill Nighy. Co-written with award-winning writer Danny Brocklehurst, this new six-part series is filled with dark and unexpected plot twists as forensic psychiatrist Joel Lazarus, faced with the tragic death of his father, also a psychiatrist, finds himself turning detective. Jen Gannon has seen Lazarus. She's here to review it with us this evening. Set us up with this one, Jen.
Yeah, you want to feel lazy? Think about Harlan Coben, like the man. I mean, I read an interview with him and he's saying he was, you know, writing in the backseat of an Uber just the other day. So, I mean, we're in Stephen King territory here. This man is prolific. So this is his first original idea that's not based on one of his novels that's gone to Prime with Danny Brocklehurst, who people would know. He used to be a writer for Shameless and then he's the creator of the crime caper drama comedy Brassic. So it's knitting those two styles together slightly. So you have Joel Lazarus, who's played by Sam Claflin, and he returns home after his father, Bill, played by Bill Nighy, his apparent death by suicide. So Laz and his father are these respected psychiatrists. And when we first meet Laz, he's attended a session with a supposed serial killer in this high security psychiatric hospital. Then he heads off to meet his sister, Jenna. And life has been tough for the Lazarus family with the untimely and unexpected death of their father. But then they were also dealing with 25 years previously to this, the murder of their sister Sutton. And this murder, they never found out anyone responsible for it. Nobody was arrested. And Laz is tormented by this, obviously, but doubly so because he sees a flash of the killer coming out of his sister's bedroom. So that's on his mind all the time. So you have all this unresolved grief that is surrounding this family and that's compounded by the death of their father. So Laz is returning home and he's confronted by the ghosts of his past, including his ex-wife Bella, played by Carla Crome, who runs this bar that suspiciously only plays seemingly 90s trip hop. You feel like you're back in the living room of This Life at one of those parties.
I have no issue with that. That's
neither,
fine.
Neither. It was nice to hear Sneaker Pimps again and poured his head. But anyway, so she's there. And then his best friend, Seth, who is a policeman played by David Finn. And then he also is greeted by some actual ghosts. So it is a ghost story. It's that kind of show. So Laz is trying to make sense of his father's death. He goes into his office. And this office is something to behold, guys. It's palatial. This office is like the lair of a supervillain. It's like the deck of the Titanic. It's massive.
Belongs in Gotham City.
It really does. Yeah. It's CGI'd to the max. And that kind of takes you out of the reality of the situation initially, as well as just this premise of Laz being visited by these ghosts. He's kind of visited by the ghost of murderous pasts, because when he steps into it, it's almost like this place is a portal to the netherworld or a portal to the past.
Okay, I've got to be very careful about this clip that I'm going to play, but I'm going to play this clip anyway. This is Laz confronting his father, Dr. Lazarus, in that room about his work practices.
What measures did you take to keep him safe?
I'm sorry, but it almost sounds like you're questioning my ethics.
Harry was your patient, Dad. His safety is your responsibility.
And you don't think I took that responsibility seriously? I mean, I agree, that would be terrible, unforgivable, but is it true? Let's unpack it together, shall we?
Yeah, fine. Dad, explain it to me. Explain Harry. Because here, you've written the trauma Harry has suffered is so buried, so deeply entwined in his personality.
In cases such as this, progress can only be achieved by taking risks, taking that leap into...
the abyss? He's dead, Dad. This poor man is dead. Killed by his greatest fear, this paedophile. How is that in any world progress?
Don't stir it. I was in the middle of just having a whole other discussion about something completely different. So that is, again, a confrontation that occurs between the two of them, because there is, and again, I spoke to Harlan Coben about this earlier in the week, an air of the supernatural in this, which is not something you normally associate with Harlan Coben, is it?
No, and it turns out, so Laz is kind of there to seemingly solve a series of murders that might lead him to the answer to exactly what happened to his sister all those years ago, because he's visited by these old patients of his father's. So that's, there's all these clues there with these ghosts and he has to piece it back together. I mean, it's a bit Sixth Sense.
They're the coldest of cold cases.
Very, very much so. And it kind of reminded me initially of those high concept 90s thrillers that we saw after the post X-Files boom, where you had something like Millennium or Medium. But the thing about this is it's just not as fun as those shows, and it's not as dark as those shows either, which is unfortunate. I mean, I think if you showed something like Laz having this breakdown and losing his grip completely on reality, there's something darker or meatier there about, you know, mistrusting him as a person if he's wandering around with these mad ideas. But everyone in his life takes him seriously when he's saying, a ghost came to me and told me that they'd murdered someone, and goes to his friend Seth. And, you know, Seth is a great character, I have to say. Like, they do great work here with what they have. David Finn, he adds a reality to it. He grounds it a bit by kind of going, what are you talking about? That sounds a bit crazy, but that's all he gets to do. But I think if they had to push that further and Laz had been this unreliable narrator that you see wandering around and thinking, where is this coming from? And they do try and get him help, or think that he's gone completely, he's been subsumed by grief and this is how it's manifesting it, that would have been more interesting. This leaps off into unreality straight away.
Do we care about any of these characters?
No. I mean, I think Sam Claflin is a fine main character. We've seen him do work in Daisy Jones and the Six, where he's serviceable. He's good at being a leading man. But here he does a lot of shouting. So be warned. If you like Sam Claflin shouting in a car, listening to the windmills of your mind over and over again, which plays a big part in this series, that's what you're looking at here. And if that doesn't sound like a good night in for you, then this is skippable for you. And I do think there's something about the days of, you know, Robbie Coltrane or Robson Green as these grizzled protagonists suffering from this mental anguish that I miss on TV. I miss that so much because it's a bit erring on the bland side, a bit erring on the basic side for me as a protagonist of this show that should be about generational trauma. It should be about the lasting effect of grief. And it does do that, but it doesn't do it enough. It doesn't dig into it enough. And we're kind of distracted by the ghosty part of it.
Okay, dare I ask for stars?
I don't think Jesus Christ himself could raise this Lazarus for me anyway. I really don't. But the thing about Harlan Coben is you don't like this show, there's going to be three others done by the time this segment finishes. So it's got to be a two for me.
Jen, thank you so much for coming in tonight. And our TV is brief this week, because just before we finish tonight, I want to remind you that tomorrow night we'll be coming to you live from the Pavilion Theatre, where the winner of this year's RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Frances McManus will be announced. We'll be live here on RTE Radio 1 from 7 o'clock tomorrow as usual. There are a handful of tickets available to come and join us in person tomorrow night in the Pavilion Theatre from 7. There are ticket details at paviliontheatre.ie. And that is Thursday night's Arena, produced by Sheila O'Callaghan. Paula Shields was our researcher, broadcast coordinator. Tonight was Ollie Hamilton and Jamie Doyle was on sound. I will talk to you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock live from the Pavilion Theatre. And after news, John Creedon is next.